Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Brian.
And I want to thank Greg for picking me up at the airport and all the phone calls I got from Larry and the two young ladies that made me feel warm and welcome down in Austin, Texas last year at the state convention. And I especially want to thank Ed and Ross. I mean, what an honor it was for me yesterday to sit there and see two men up there representing 104 years of sobriety in AA. I'm not just talking about around AA, I'm talking about in AA. 104 years, in the greatest century known to man, the 20th century, they had stayed sober, the last part, the half of the 20th century. That's how I think. It just blows me away. I mean, I've stayed sober for the last quarter, and I have every intentions of marching into the 21st century with Ed, with Ross, and hopefully all of us, you know? And I'm glad to be here, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. I come from New York. And I don't remember the first time I picked up a drink, but I do remember the first time I had a blackout. Somehow, looking back over my life, I seem to be able to remember more things about growing up as a boy than I can most things as a man. I can remember certain things with pinpoint accuracy as a child than I can most things as a man. And I remember when I was about 13 years old, it was a Saturday afternoon, a friend of mine, Johnny, and I, we had some money in our papers from hustling papers in the saloons the night before. And I went up to 97th Street between Lexington and Park Avenue, and it was an old abandoned building. And I walked to the back of the building, there was a whole camp of winos all passed out laying there. And I remember kicking one, giving him the high sign, he came out, and I gave him enough money to go get his three pints of Sneaky Pete. That was five-star Muscatel. I think in those days it was about 30, 31 cents a pint. And I remember this man as one of the most handsomest men I could ever remember. He stood at about 6'2", he had jet black curly hair, big blue eyes. The most he could have been was anywhere from maybe 25 to 31, 32 years old. And here he was, an old, young, dirty man. He was a wino. I come from a work ethic background, and the only requirement for becoming a man was a desire to work. As long as you had a desire to work, you could beat your wife, beat the kids, beat the system. You could beat anything you wanted, as long as you had a desire to work. And these winos broke the cardinal rule. They didn't work. So they were ostracized to the ballparks and vacant lots and these vacant buildings. And I gave him the money to go make the run. And he made the run to the liquor store. He came back with three pints, one for me, one for Johnny, one for himself. He got his pint. He scurried back into the back of the building. Johnny and I went behind the building. I cracked my pint. Johnny cracked his pint. We started drinking and we're laughing and giggling and arm wrestling and punching each other. And remember knocking up the two pints. And we're walking up the street to dig out this wino to make the run again. And I remember walking up and I'm bumping into the people and I'm pushing them aside. It was my first experience with beer muscles. I was about this high and already I'm pushing people aside, you know. And I dug him out and he made the run. And I remember it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I cracked that second pint. I remember looking at this microphone the same way. I put that pint to my mouth. The next thing I knew, I come out of a blackout. My mother had my head over the kitchen tubs. I was throwing up all this wine into the tubs. My two brothers were leaning over. They were punching the hell out of me, screaming at me. Where had I been? The neighbors had come in and told my mother that her son was drunk. He's staggering all over the neighborhood. My mother was out. The family was out. The neighbors were out. They scoured the whole neighborhood. And they didn't find me till about 11 o'clock at night. And I just couldn't tell them where I had been. I mean, one minute it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I put that pint to my mouth, and the next minute it was 11 o'clock at night, and I just didn't know. This wasn't the first time I had been drunk. I'd been drunk many a time at these parties for these returning soldiers and sailors and Marines, wax and waves and bams, all these keg parties, all these big block parties. But this was the first time I had pulled a blank. This was the first time something else had happened, and it was exciting. There was something exciting about this blackout. It was like sort of the original Back to the Future yesterday. I mean, one minute you're there, next minute you're gone, and you're in fighting the elements and the gods, and next thing you come back, you're bloodied but unbowed. I mean, there was something manly about it. I remember walking up the neighborhood, and one of the saloon owners come walking down. I stopped him, because this was in the back of my mind. And I stopped and I remember looking up at him. I'm explaining the story to him and he's there with a big smile on his face. He got his hands in his hips and he's rocking back and forth. And when I was finished, he turned around and he said to me, "Brian, were you drunk?" I said, yeah, I was drunk. He said, were you drinking? I said, yeah. And he just leaned back and shrugged. He didn't say anything. He just shrugged, tossed my hair, walked around me, and kept walking. It seems like I had been born with and raised with this alcoholic shrug. I had seen this alcoholic shrug all my life. I go in a bar, there wouldn't be a soul in a bar. I said, where the hell is everybody? They say, yeah, they're out looking for Joe's car. He doesn't know where he parked it last night. They'd be going up and down looking for the car. And somebody would say, was Joe drinking last night? And they'd say, yeah. Was Joe drunk last night? And they'd say, yeah. They just shrugged. Went about their business. Didn't say anything. I'd walk in the bar. They say, Mary's on the phone. She's crazy. She's hysterical. She doesn't know where she left the children. And somebody would say, is Mary drinking? They say, yeah. Is Mary drunk? They say, yeah. And they just shrugged. Nobody ever said anything about the shrug. Now, when I was 14, you had to be 16 to get in the pool room. And that's where the big guys hung out. That's where the action took place, in the pool rooms. So I broke into the church rectory, and I robbed the whole pad of baptismal papers along with the church seal. And I forged my the baptismal papers and made myself 16. I sold off the rest of them. And at 16, you had to be 18 to get your seaman's papers without your mother's, without your parents' permission. So with the phony papers, I got my seaman's papers. And at 17, I ran away and I went to sea. And no matter where I traveled in the world, this shrug followed me. It was like some kind of international voodoo. No matter where I went, the shrug was there. I remember in Singapore, my first trip, I was in a nightclub and I got into a fight. I got pretty bad cut up and pretty bad beat up. And they came and they took me to the hospital where they stitched me up, and then they took me and they literally had me in a hole, threw me in a hole for 3 days. And in those days, Singapore was still a British Crown colony. And when he pulled me out and he put me in a docket, I looked like one of these punk rockers or one of these wrestlers. Half of the head was shaved like a mohawk and all stitched up, and the rest of the hair was all pointed with blood and peroxide and iodine, and my face was all cut up, and the T-shirt was stuck to the stitches, and I'm a mess standing there in the docket. And sitting up there was the British magistrate with a big white curly wig on him and a black flowing robe, and representing me was the American consulate. And I remember the magistrate leaning over saying to the American consul, he says, was that bloke drinking? And the American consul leans over the guy, he looks at me, he says, were you drinking? And I leaned over and I looked at the American consul, eyeball to eyeball, one American to another. I said, was I drinking? I said, of course I was drinking. You don't think I look like this sober, do you? I said, what the hell kind of an American do you think I am anyway? I said, of course I was drinking. We're all drunk. And he looked up and he said to the magistrate, he said, yes, your magistrate, the bloke was drinking. And the judge leaned back and he went like this there. The American consul went like that. The captain went like that. I went like that. And ladies and gentlemen, that's my story in a nutshell. It was just one shrug after another. That's where alcohol took me. It reduced me and my life to a human shrug. They said the ship sailed for Panama last night. Was Brian aboard? The ship came back from Panama. Was Brian aboard? Does Brian have to do time? Whatever happened to that nice girl Brian was going with? Where the hell is Brian? In 1969, I was on a real bad drunk. I was really on a bad drunk. And I come out of a blackout. I'm holding a phone. This phone to my ear, and I'm weaving back and forth, and I'm listening to this voice at the end of the phone, and he's saying, take it easy, Brian, give us your address, I'll send a couple of men over to talk to you. And I couldn't recognize the voice. I couldn't, you know, I didn't know who this guy was on the phone, so I kept throwing words out, hoping maybe he'd fill in, I could fill in around a sentence and figure out who he was. He kept saying, take it easy, Brian, give us your address, I'll send a couple of, I said, wait a minute, what do you mean send a couple of men over to talk to me? I said, who the hell are you? He says, I'm so-and-so from Intergroup. Now, if you never heard the word Intergroup before, you'll have to admit it sounds like some kind of communist word. You know? I said, Intergroup? I said, what the hell are you talking about? I said, who are you? He says, I'm so-and-so from Alcoholics Anonymous, Intergroup. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous from Intergroup? I said, how the hell did you get my number? He said, you just called us up. I said, I call you up? What the hell would I call you up for? He said, take it easy, Brian. Give it you. I said, you hold it right there, mister. Don't you send in anybody around my house starting trouble. You want something, I'll give you a punch in the pouch. That's what I'll give you. I hung up the phone. I sat down and a sweat started pouring off me. And my head kept racing back and forth trying to figure out what in God's name did I do this time that Intergroup would be after me. I mean, the only thing I knew about Intergroup was these Second World War movies with Humphrey Bogart and Errol Flynn. And in those movies, when an Intergroup was after you, it meant one thing. So I put the light out and I stood silent there. And a little while later, I went and I looked out the keyhole there. You know, then I crept across the kitchen floor and I leaned up against the window and I pulled the shades and I searched out the doorways and the lampposts, thinking maybe I'd see an Intergroup guy up there, you know, looking up. What the hell did I know? By 1970, I'm on another drunk, a wicked drunk. This was a bad drunk I was on. And I come out of a blackout and I'm on this phone talking to this guy again. And the guy told me where the meeting was. And the meeting was the old Butterfield Group in 72nd Street between 3rd and 2nd Avenue. And I went to the meeting. And the only thing I heard at that meeting was stay out of one bar at a time. Stay out of one bar at a time. Now, I'm sure looking back on it, what the man was saying, stay away from one drink at a time. But I heard stay out of one bar at a time. So I walked up to the 72nd Street and 3rd Avenue, and I walked all the way from 73rd Street and 3rd Avenue to 93rd Street and 3rd Avenue. And there were bars to the right and saloons to the left and beer gardens and cafes, but I was a man on a mission. And I walked straight ahead and I got up to 93rd to one of the bars I drank in. I walked in, I ordered up my usual solving up drink, which was a large club soda with a big twist of lemon. And I'm standing at the bar, and next thing I felt my body starting to shake, and I went into a fit. And when I come out of the fit, I was in an ambulance with a friend of mine, Jackie, and his big attendant kneeling on top of me, and he had something in my mouth, and I heard the sirens, and I couldn't figure out who this guy was sticking this thing in my mouth, and I grabbed him, I rolled him over, I got on top of him, I started punching the shit out of him. He started screaming to stop the ambulance came to a halt. The driver came running around, he opened the door, he stuck his head in to see what was going on. I run over, I gave him a kick and a push, I jumped down, hit the ground running, took off like a shot. Jackie ran over, he jumped him, he gave me a kick and a push, he shot the ground, he's up running after me. I ran up this block, Jackie's chasing me, I ran down this block, Jackie's chasing me, I spot a bar, I go running in the bar, I'm huffing and puffing in the bar, Jackie comes running in, he's huffing and puffing, I grabbed him on the side, I said, Jackie, what the hell happened? God damn it, what was all that about? What happened? He says, I don't know. He says, you come in the bar, everything is all right. Next thing, you went into some kind of fit. Now, the only thing I could attribute that fit to was this Intergroup Anonymous, you know? I mean, they told me to stay out of one bar at a time. I passed all these bars, nothing happened to me. I go in one stinking bar, and I woke up in an ambulance. I remember buying a drink and saying to Jackie, Jesus, no wonder these people are anonymous. I mean, they could kill you in broad daylight and never leave a fingerprint. I said, that's it with this Intergroup Anonymous stuff, Jackie. They had one crack at me, they goddamn near killed me. I said, that's it. In 1969, we're about 3 days out of Panama Canal, heading for the Suez Canal, going up. I was on a round-the-world trip, and we're heading for the Suez Canal. I go up to Naples. And I come off watch, I've been drinking, we had robbed a hole, I had booze stashed all over the ship. And I come off and I'm sitting in my room, I'm drinking in the forecastle, and all of a sudden word came down, I'm batting down the hatches, door down the porthole, a storm was coming up. And the storm came and I'm drinking, and somehow I got in my head that this storm is looking for me. This storm come looking for me. And the ship started to rock and roll, and I'm drinking, I'm getting peeved off. Finally I said, that's it, I'm not putting up with this shit. You know, I took a bottle, I went out on deck, I threw the door open, I got out on deck, I started laughing at the storm and peeing against it and throwing puns, and I'm singing, I'm dancing. Wave picks me up, slams me up against the housing, and breaks my shoulder. Now, they wanted to take me off in Alexandria in Egypt, and I figured, oh, the hell with that. I might as well tough it out and get off in Naples. You have to get off, you know, a choice between Egypt and Naples, you know. Well, anyway, they take me off, and they had me in a hospital in Naples for 3 days where they put me in a body cast. They had the big bar underneath the arm. And I hadn't drank now, maybe in a week, you know, 2 weeks. And the agent came, and he picks me up, and we got to get on the train to make the long trek all the way to Naples. Then there was a car that picked us up and took us all the way out to Rome, I mean, to the airport. We got out there. It was about a two-hour layover. And I said to the guy, I said, look, you married? He says, yeah. I said, you got kids? He says, yeah. I said, look, man, the plane is right here. I don't need you. You got a long trip back to Naples. I said, what the hell? I said, I don't need a babysitter. I'll just get a few postcards right in New York and let the boys know what the hell is going on. He said, all right. So he took off. I'm sitting at the bar. And then I ordered a cappuccino. Yeah, let me have a little cappuccino. And I throw a little brandy in there. Come on, throw some brandy in there. Throws in a brandy. I'm drunk, I'm first class, I'm drinking all the martinis. By the time that gangway went down in Kennedy Airport, I come off that gangway like a runaway construction boom. Man, I'm banging and beating people, are ducking, I'm boom, boom. I fell in the escalator, I'm in a bar jammed, and sparks are coming out, and people falling on top of me. In 1970, I'm about 5 days out, we're bound for Japan. And I'm on a drunk, got booze stashed all over the ship, we're all drinking. And the working down, batting down a hatchet, storm is coming up. And somehow I said, geez, that goddamn storm won't let go. It's still trying to get me, you know. By the time the storm hit, I get the bop, I staggered out on deck. I'm yelling and cursing, peeing against it, throwing punches, singing songs. A wave picks me up, slams me up against the housing, and shatters the lower part of my back. So they got me belly down until they got to Yokohama, where they took me off and they had me in the operating room, and they had me in the hospital for 16 days. Now the agent comes up to picks me up, and we got a long trek all the way out to Tokyo. And I hadn't drank now, maybe in 3 weeks, a month, I forget, you know. We get out, there's a two-hour layover. I said to the guy, you married? He says, yeah. I said, you got kids? He said, yeah. I said, look, I don't need a babysitter. You got a long trip back to Yokohama. I said, what the hell, I'll just get a few postcards to let the boys know what's going on. I'm sitting there at the bar, I'm right in there, and I tell the guy, heat up a little sake. Yeah, get the coffee pot going there, a little sake, you know. I'm drinking on a plane. I'm all drunk. I passed out when it came to. There was a big puddle of blood where I had been hemorrhaging. The drain had come out. So they got me in the back of the plane. They got me down. They're wiping me clean. They had to borrow one of those old-fashioned Kotex, and they packed me with the Kotex. And by the time the plane got to Anchorage, Alaska, they had to get my luggage out to give me a change of clothing. By the time I get home, I'm sitting home in the house a couple of days later, and I'm thinking about this going to sea. It seems like every time I went to sea now, there was a whole school of angry Moby Dicks out there waiting for me. I mean, I didn't mind going to sea, but I didn't want to die over it, you know. So I went back working in the tunnels. I'm a retired sand hog. And for those of you who don't know what a sand hog is, we're the compressed air workers in New York. We're the ones who go in the compression chamber. We build the tunnels. We're the miners there in New York. And most of my life, that's what I did. I went to sea, or I was a sand hog, or I was a bartender, or I hustled whatever I could to make a living. And I went working in the tunnels. And in 1971, I was on a drunk, a mean drunk, a wicked drunk. And it was banging at the door. And all of a sudden I hear, open up the door, Brian, I'm going to kick it in. God damn it, open up the door. So I got up and I opened it up, and it was the union delegate. I said, keep your voice down. What do you want, the whole neighborhood know my business? Keep your voice down. He come in, he said, phew, man, this place stinks. I said, what the hell are you doing? He went, he opened the drapes, threw the window up. He said, God, the place was a mess, man. You know, you can imagine. He said, what the hell are you doing? I said, what are you making a big deal about? I said, I'm just having a couple of drinks. He said, how long do you think you're having a couple of drinks? There was something in his tone that I knew I was in kind of trouble. I said, I sort of remember people coming and going, and I said, I don't know, a few days. He said, you've been on this drunk 6 weeks. He said, when the hell are you coming off? When are you coming back to work? I can't keep covering your job. I was the dynamiter on the job. He said, when are you coming back? I said, well, what's today? He said, today's Wednesday. I said, all right. I said, I'll be back Monday. He said, Brian, please. I said, look, I'll be back Monday. Because I knew all I ever needed to come off of heat. All I ever needed, no matter where I was in the world, to come off a drunk, usually I could bail out in about 3 days. All I needed was a floor, a toilet, and water, and silence. That's all. And you go through the whips and the jingles and the shakes and the horrors and the run, and usually I could get all the badness out in about 3 days. And I did. Monday morning, I went back to the job. They called for the dynamite. I loaded up 300 sticks of dynamite on the cage. I'm dropping down 850 feet from tunnel level. Then when you get up and you get into the compression chamber, before you come out on the other side, all the electricity is shut off for fear that maybe when we start loading the heading, an electric charge could set it off and kill everybody up there. So everything is done by flashlights and headlights and air lights. So we got up and they start loading the heading. And all of a sudden, I went into a fit. And they started screaming, what's going on? He said, I don't know, it's Brian, he's over there. No, no, he's over there, watch out, you're standing on him. And I'm pulling out all the dynamite, and I'm rolling around the caps. So they called out for the bomb squad. And at that time, there was a lot of dynamite being stolen off the construction sites. There was a lot of bombing going on in New York. So by the time they got me out, they had me on a stretcher, tied down a stretcher. By the time they got me up, They had the bomb squad there with binoculars and baseball bats, and they got guns on me, thinking they got the mad bomber. And they didn't want me to, they claimed that it was an epileptic fit I had in the heading, and they didn't want me working in the tunnel anymore around the dynamite or running a motor or any type of machinery, because they won't allow out epileptics in the tunnel for fear that maybe I could have set the charge off and killed or wiped out the tunnel. So I had to go to Lenox Hill Hospital for a whole series, a whole battery of epilepsy tests, which I did. And the second day later, I'm sitting outside the neurosurgeon's office, and he steps out and goes, "Mr. Mines?" I go, "Yeah." Gives me the high sign. I get up, and just before I stepped into his office, I stopped. I took a big, deep breath. And as I walked in, he's shuffling around the charts and the photographs. And he said, "Well, Mr. Mines," he said, "everything here looks pretty negative." And I heard the word negative. And I let my breath out just a little bit. And I said, "What do you mean negative, doctor?" He said, "Well, everything here looks pretty good." And I let my breath out just a little bit more. I said, "You mean to say, doctor, I'm not an epileptic?" He said, "No, you're not an epileptic. You're an alcoholic." I said, yeah, but I didn't have an epileptic fit in the tunnel. He said, "No, you had an alcoholic seizure." I said, "Oh, thank God. I gave him what the hell do I care about being an alcoholic? I couldn't care less about being an alcoholic. As far as I was concerned, any man worth his salt was an alcoholic. The key was I wasn't an epileptic. They're the ones that'll get you fired. So I had him put it in writing. I went back, I saw the safe in the engineer, and I threw it on his desk. I said, "Here, I'm an alky, not an epi. Here it is right here. Alcoholic." He said, "Oh," so he says, "You're an alcoholic, huh, Brian?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "So am I." I said, "No kidding." He says, "You want a drink?" I said, "Sure." Close the door, he pulled a bottle out, we start sucking on a bottle. They call for the dynamite, I load the cage, I'm dropping down the tunnel level, and life was good. I mean, God, I had my job back. I'm solid. They can't fire me. I'm only an alky. I just found a new alcoholic with a bottle tucked away. I mean, life was good. This friend of mine, Joe, we're born and raised together. Joe has been sober in AA for 7 years. Joe and I, we were born and raised together in Yorkville. Went to sea together, and now we're working the tunnels together. He had heard about the trouble. Now, Joe had been 12-stepping me all these 7 years that he was in AA. And he heard about the trouble that I was in now with the dynamite and the job and federal agents. So he came up and he said, "Brian, why don't you come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting?" And I agreed to go. And the only reason I agreed to go is because I couldn't seem to get a handle on these fits. I mean, I was convulsing in subway platforms in the middle of the street. Now here it wasn't a job and I'm in a lot of trouble. And I agreed to go. And at that meeting, I heard the speaker stand up there and he guaranteed, "It's impossible to get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink." He guaranteed it's impossible to get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink. And as the meeting ended, I made a beeline for the stairs. Everybody stopped. And they all started to say to our Father. And I spun around. I was shocked. And I searched out the crowd, and there was my friend Joe. He was had his eyes hooded, and he was holding his two fingers. And he was rocking back and forth saying to our Father. And I looked at him, and I said to myself, "Ah, Joe, what the hell did they do to you, Joe?" I mean, here was a man born and raised in the neighborhood, and there he is now rocking to Jesus and psalm singing with the best of them. We went for coffee afterward. We're sitting in a restaurant, and everybody from AA came in. They started filling in around their seats. And I leaned over to him, and I said, "Joe, how long have you been in AA?" He said, 7 years. You know? And he pushed the meeting book over to me and he says, "Brian, why don't you try 90 days, 90 meetings? Why don't you try 90 days, 90 meetings? And I pushed the meeting book back to him and I said, "Look, Joe, maybe you don't mind sitting there in the front row humped over, squinting up at the speaker, slurping your lips for sobriety like some kind of AA Quasimodo." I said, "Joe, that's not my idea of what being a man is all about." I said, "What happened to your pride, Joe? What happened to your dignity?" And he said, "Brian, please, please try 90 days, 90 meetings. I said, "Joe, mark my words, Joe. If you keep hanging around with those people over there, you're going to be here for another 7 years. Can't you see, Joe, you're being bullshitted, man? You're throwing good, hard-earned money in a basket full of happy horseshit. It's all smoke and mirrors. Hocus pocus. Now you see it, now you don't. Now they guarantee it, now they don't. A blind man can see what goes on here, Joe. What the hell is the matter with you?" And he said, "Brian, please, Fry not, I said, Joe. Just then the bells from the church started ringing. I said, Joe, you better get back there. Somebody took your job. You better get back there. That was in the fall of 1971. I went through all the holidays, never picked up a drink. I mean, I went through Christmas, New Year's, whatever it was. I was back working, had the job solid, you know. I'm back in the bars, I'm wheeling and dealing, having a great time. And I live in 86th Street, in Yorkville, right in the dead center, and that's where the St. Patrick's Day parade breaks up. Now, I hadn't drank maybe in about 4 months. And on every St. Patrick's Day in my neighborhood, people come from all over, and there's a reunion from about 3rd Avenue to Park Avenue, both sides. Hundreds and hundreds of people, and I know them all. And my two nieces came in from Westchester, and I remember walking up toward the parade. I had a camel hair coat on, a Russian Cossack hat on, with big sprigs of shamrock and a big green tie, and one niece on one arm, niece on the other arm, and I'm marching up, and everybody's screaming, yelling at me, and I'm waving at everybody and punching me. And I got up to where my crew drank, and they're passing around a bottle. Now, I hadn't drank in about 4 months. And the bottle came to me, I pulled the plug, I took a swig, and this time I was in the grip of the grape for 2 weeks. For 2 weeks, the fears this time were so great, I never left the apartment. I had the doors locked, the windows locked, the shades pulled down, the phone off the hook. The only phone calls I made was at the liquor store in the morning, had the booze delivered, and for 2 weeks I was totally isolated. For 2 weeks I was alone, and only an alcoholic would understand I loved it. God, I loved it. I mean, the only friends and enemies that I had was the furniture. I was standing in the middle of the room with my head up, my shoulders thrown back, with the wind gently tussling my hair. My eyes squinting with mirth, searching out the horizon. My nostrils flaring with excitement, my teeth bared with lust, my chest slowly heaving, my hands opening and closing with anticipation. I would stand there truly a man of destiny, a man amongst men, all things to women. Jack and Nazis be on their knees with her arms around my legs saying, I love you, Brian. Please, take the money. Take the money. And I'd throw my head back and laugh and say, money? You can't buy a man like me with money. And I'd pick her up and I'd throw her out the door. Next minute, to be banging at the door. I'd open up. It'd be Sophia Loren. She says, I heard about you, Brian. Just once. Just once. And I'd throw her out and I'd slam the door and I'd yell through the door, why don't you goddamn women leave me alone? Can't you see I'm only human? Leave me alone, goddamn it. Or I'd stand in the middle of the room huffing and puffing because I had just knocked out Muhammad Ali for the heavyweight championship of the world. And I would always knock him out March 16th so they would beg me to lead the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And lead it I would, and I could see myself in 86th Street and 5th Avenue making that wide turn. And the major domo would be standing there with the stick in hand. And when Brian, the champion of the world, the champion being possessed, he'd bring the stick down and all of a sudden the pipes and the fiddles and the drums and all the screaming, the yelling, the cops would be on the horses skittering all over the place, and the women, and the cops on the ground with their arms locked, trying to hold back the surging crowd of women, and they're screaming and yelling, there's Brian, there's the champ of the world, there he is. And every now and then I'd hear a cop say, what a man, what a man. I'd be standing in the middle of the room, I'd be holding this bottle up, and I'd be weaving back and forth, and the big tears of love and gratitude would be pouring down my eyes. The hair would be wild and matted from the however long I was on that drunk, and the beard, and the vomity, dribbly old t-shirt, everything I drank and puked was all over the shirt, and barely hanging off my hips were these warm, wrinkled, faithful, farty pair of shorts. And I'd be weaving back and forth, and the tears would be coming down my cheeks, because it was the 3rd year in a row I had won the Academy Award. Well, anyway, April 1st, 1972, April Fool's Day, Intergroup finally came and got me. And they carted me off to a detox. And I don't ever want to forget, that they were taking me down the alcoholic section, and my brother-in-law had one arm, and the nurse had the other arm. And the hair was wild and matted from that 2 week drunk, and I had 2 week growth, and I had vomity, dribbly old t-shirt, and I had a pea-stained pair of pants with the fly broken half open, half closed, so I never needed a belt. You just pull them off, kick them in the corner, or you pick them up and put them on. And naturally, those warm, wrinkled, faithful, farty pair of shorts. I mean, they went with me from that first drink. If I staggered down the street, they staggered. If I fell in a gutter, they fell in a gutter. If I got locked up for the weekend, they got locked up for the weekend. And mark my words, ladies and gentlemen, one day shorts like those will be holding their own meetings, believe me. And they deserve them. And as we got close to the nurse's station, right opposite was the men's lounge. And through the corner of my eye, I saw this guy step out, and he saw the three of us coming down. And he stepped back into the lounge. I could hear him say, "Hey, guys, come out, look at this guy, a real wolf, man. Take a look at this guy here." And they come out, and they all start laughing. Ooh! And they're saying, "Don't touch him, nurse, you get locked, your fingers are right off, one day at a time," and they're all laughing. Now, this is the first time in my life that a man or woman ever laughed at me, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I remember standing there with my head down, and his voice, this soul-sickening voice, this voice that had tortured me ever since I was a child, was digging into me, saying, "Look at them laughing at you. You've been nothing but a disgrace all your life. No matter where you sailed, you left an oil slick a mile wide. Can't you ever do anything right? Can't you ever be a man? Don't let them laugh at you. Get your head up. Look at these bastards in the face." And I kept trying to get my head up to look at these guys that were laughing. But it seems like somebody used a machete and cut up all my neck muscles and my back muscles. I just couldn't get my head up. And if there's one thing at that moment I wish I could have done, ladies and gentlemen, and that was to grab myself by the head of the hair, yank my face up, and spit right into it. That's how I felt about myself. It was the second day over my 38th birthday. I was physically, mentally, spiritually bankrupt. I was financially bankrupt. And I was sexually bankrupt. I see now sobriety. I've been slipping in and out of intimacy, having the trouble with sex since I was about 28 years old. And it bothered me. I was a sand hog and a bartender and a seaman. And I'd be sitting at the bar, working the bar. And the guys would be talking about the girls. And he took the girl home last night. He made love to her three times. The guy over here took the girl home. He made love to her three times. And the guy over there, he took the girl home. He made love to her three times. Well, I see now in sobriety that if these guys were taking these girls home, making love two or three times a night, one thing is for sure, they didn't drink what I was drinking, that's for sure. You don't drink that shit and go home and make love two or three times. You go home and fall out of the bed two or three times. I know for a fact the closest they're going to come to sex that night is when they pee-pee two or three times. Now, I don't want to belabor this sex thing, but the only reason I'm throwing it out there is because maybe some guy out there kind of knows what I'm talking about. As for the women, they know what I'm talking about. And they had me there 5 days. I sweated dead. I got all the badness out. They suggested when I got out, 90 days, 90 meetings, get a meeting book, get a sponsor. I had Joe waiting for me. Sit up front, 90 days, 90 meetings, get a meeting book, get a sponsor, sit up front. I came out, and after the meeting, I buttonholed one of these old-timers. I get him on the side. I say, "Look, just between you and I, nothing to do with those people over there. Where did you get this concept of 90 days, 90 meetings? Where did you get 90 days, 90 meetings? I mean, not how come 75 days and 70 meetings? Or 63 days or 70? Where did you get 90 days, 90 meetings?" And none of the old-timers knew. Not only didn't they know, but they couldn't care less. They said, "Look, that had nothing to do with AA. That's some rehab stuff, is that? In AA, we don't pick up the first drink one day at a time. We're about not drinking one day at a time." But that wasn't good enough for me. I had to find out where they got 90 days, 90 meetings, because I had no intentions of making the same mistake twice. I remember when I was a kid in grammar school, I was always being beaten and punished over these mystical, esoteric numbers. I was always being kept after school. I remember there was the 12 apostles and the 10 commandments. The 12 commandments, the 10 apostles, there was the 12 lost tribes of Israel, the 7 deadly sins, the 8 ones of the ancient world, the 9 planets, the 4 seas. Moses was in the desert for 40 years. Columbus was on the Atlantic for 40 days, 40 nights. And now me, 90 days, 90 meetings. But it didn't take me long to figure it out. And I finally came to the conclusion that you have to be here 90 days, 90 meetings just to understand what the hell they're talking about. I mean, there's a very sophisticated way of speaking at these meetings. The topic would be, "You see, when you made a decision not to make a decision, you made a decision." They go, "Oh my God, what a topic, what a topic." "You see, at the very section, the very second of not taking the action, by not taking the action, you took the action." They go, "Oh my God, circuit speaker, circuit speaker." The one that got me was, "You see, you can't keep it unless you give it away. In fact, you have to give it away to keep it. And the more you give, the more you get." And I'd lean over and say to Joe, what the hell are they giving away? They don't work. They're all unemployed on welfare. Joe, they're even on alimony. Can't you see, Joe? He'd say, see what? I say, we're being bullshitted. We're throwing good money. He said, my God, are you still in that kick? And he'd get his cigarettes and he'd get his coffee. I'd see him working his way to sit somewhere else. And I'd say to myself, go ahead, run. Run, you stinking AAS kisser. I mean, that's all they seem to do around here. Stay away from a drink, come to meetings, and kiss ass. I said, let me tell you, Joey boy, it'd be a cold wind blowing through hell today to get a man like me to bend over and start kissing ass. And it seems like, I remember I'd sit up right up front, and I'd have my arms crossed, my legs crossed, and I wouldn't look at the speaker. You look straight ahead, because the one thing you don't want to do as a beginner is make eye contact. Because if you make eye contact, you might just have to nod. You know what I mean? And God forbid you smile. If you smile, that means they're winning. You know? So you look straight ahead. And it seems like the first 90 days that I kept running into the same cluster of speakers. The same. And it seems like each speaker had a little gimmick that they were selling. And I nicknamed them. Easy Does It, Craig. One Day at a Time, Larry. First Things First, Ed. You know? I had the nicknames for the speaker. And they introduced this guy and he gets up there. His name is Charlie. And Charlie stands up there and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell on a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. And they all started to applaud, hug him, kiss him, invite him to parties. I sat there stunned. He picked up a drink, fell on a flight of stairs, and surrendered. Man, I fell off gang stools, gangways, bar stools, garbage cans, and never in a million years would I ever stand up there and tell a shit story like that in public. I mean, he told it right in front of the girls. I remember saying, this guy will never get a girlfriend with a story like that. He'd be better off saying he fell up the stairs. I nicknamed him Staircase Charlie. A week later, they introduced Charlie again. I said, oh, there's Staircase. I got right up front and I zeroed in on every word this man had to say because it was very important to me to find out what kind of a staircase it was that made him surrender. Now, maybe he's going to say he picked up a drink and he fell down a four-story spiral staircase. Well, all right, you know. Or maybe he's going to say he picked up a drink and he fell five stories between the banisters. You got to go along with that way. But the way he looked and the way he was dressed and the way he talked, I knew in my heart that this guy was strictly a two-step foyer job. And he went into a store and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell on a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. They all started to applaud, hug him, kiss him, get his autograph, invite him to parties. And I sat there and said, why don't the guy tell the real story? Nobody, not even a kid, picks up a drink, falls on a flight of stairs and surrenders. The guy had been drinking. He'd been drunk all day. Why don't he tell him? You see, they kept telling me, Brian, keep bringing the body. Keep bringing the body. Sooner or later, the head will follow. Here it was, a week later, I'd heard the same story, but this time I heard it a little bit different. And they introduced this guy about a week later. This is the third time now. Within a month, I'm hearing this guy's story. As he went into a story, as he got close to picking up that first drink, I felt my stomach tighten up. I said, uh-oh, watch that drink, Charlie. Watch what you're doing. And he got closer to picking up the first drink. I said, Charlie, can't you see what you're doing? Watch the drink, Charlie. And Charlie said, I picked up a drink. And I said, ah, well, grease the banisters. There goes Charlie. For the first time in my life, ladies and gentlemen, I understood it was the first drink. I don't know how. It was like I was psychic or something. I could see once he picked up that drink, no way in hell could he beat the staircase. I'd lay odds from here to Vegas knowing this guy was going down that flight of stairs. It was the first time in my life I identified with the first drink. Let me tell you something. I knew all my life since I was a child I was an alcoholic. I knew I was different. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I never understood I was an alcoholic. I knew it was the first drink. I knew it. I'd be a liar if I told you something different. I knew it. But I didn't understand it. Knowing one thing and understanding is two entirely different things. You may know 1 + 1 = 2, but if you don't understand it, you'll never get to 3. It's as simple as that. I could never sober up because I never understood it was the first drink. Here, somehow, I don't know, it was a spiritual experience or whatever you want to call it. I understood this man was going down a flight of stairs. I could see my life in retrospect, all the stairs I fell down in my life because of the first drink. And things started to pick up. And I stayed away. I made meetings. I was very active. I stayed away from closed meetings and closed discussions and step meetings because of the concept of God. I walked away from the God of that I was raised in at 14, and nobody, especially AA, was going to start ramming God down my throat. But I happened to be at a meeting when I went into the concept of God. One said it was this, another said it was that, another said it was this. And I remember this man raising his hand saying the way he had heard God was G-O-D, good orderly direction. G-O-D, good orderly direction. Speaking only for myself, ladies and gentlemen, when I heard that good orderly direction, it seems like my chest split open and centuries of venom and stink and anger and confusion poured out. Here now was a God that I could understand, good orderly direction. As far as I was concerned, that's what God was supposed to have been all along, was good orderly direction. But where I came from, how I was raised, I couldn't buy it. And I remember relaxing, leaning back in my seat, looking at the speaker. Behind the speaker, it had the slogans. And it said, first things first, keep it simple, let go and let God. And the way I read it was, first things first, keep it simple, let go and let good orderly direction. And everything in my life became good orderly direction. I literally turned my will and my life over to care of good orderly direction as I understood it, which is you, AA. And the only thing you were asking of me was to try to stay away from a drink, try to do the best that I can, try to get to a meeting. And everything became good orderly direction. And it wasn't that it was a concept of God, because I really couldn't have cared less. They kept telling me, Brian, don't you ever worry about God. You pick up a drink, they won't be sending God to the detox. It's you and that first drink, remember. But the word that got me was that word, direction. Ladies and gentlemen, all my life I had been looking for some type of direction. All my life I had been looking for some type of direction. I'd be a liar if I stood up here and told you all I ever did was drink and carouse around. That's not me at all. I'd be lying to you. I was always trying to be a man. I was always trying to do the right thing. I was always shining my shoes, trying to put my best foot forward. I was always washing my face, combing my hair, trying to make that first good, long-lasting impression. I was always looking for a job. I was always trying to pay my bills. There's that saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Let me tell you, I drank with the best of intentions. I always drank with the best of intentions. I was always trying to do the right thing. I never understood when I picked up that drink to toast you, your birth of your child, or your wedding, or whatever it was that I was holding, the very thing that's going to damn me. And here I was in a room full of alcoholics offering me good orderly direction in my life. Ladies and gentlemen, I may have been everybody's drunk, but I assure you I'm nobody's fool. You're not looking at some jerk when you're looking at me. I knew right then and there, if I didn't make it with you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not going to make it as a decent human being. My record, my track record told me that. And everything became good orderly direction. And I go to the job and I see the guys up there fighting, getting drunk, fighting on the job. I walk down the street, I see a man dragging a woman out of the cab by the hair of the head, dragging her back into the bar because he hadn't finished drinking yet. I see some guy urinating between two cars, puking up against the wall. I see some old young dirty man panhandling. And I'd say, there but for the grace of good orderly direction, because I. And it simply made sense in my life. Because I no longer did any of those things. I trusted in you. And all you ever asked of me was to try to stay away from a drink. Try to do the best that I can. Try to get to a meeting. And I was about a year sober. I was working 4 to midnight. I was still working with the dynamite up in the third water tunnel that we're building there in New York. And usually I get up around 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning and I'd have breakfast. And then right across from the restaurant there was an outdoor bench outside this nightclub. And usually I'd get a container of coffee and I'd have a couple of cigarettes to get myself together before I get the train. It was about an hour drive by train and then a half hour bus. It's a long trip to get up there in the Bronx. And this day I'm sitting there and I'm looking down the street and here comes this little girl with her mother. And she looked like a little Shirley Temple. Little ringlets and dimpled knees and a little skirt on, and she had this lollipop. And she spots me, and I'm looking at her, and she comes running up and takes this big leap up on my lap. And I'm looking at this kid, and she's pointing a lollipop, and she's pushing a lollipop at me. And the mother comes up, and she looks down, and she's looking at me, and she says, she wants you to lick a lollipop. So I take the lollipop, I stick it in my mouth, I make this big sucking noise, and I take it out, the kid's giggling, she sticks it back in the mouth, jumps off my knee, and starts skipping up the block. And the mother looks at me, I'm looking at the mother, she nods, I nod, and I'm watching the two of them walk away. And all of a sudden, this tremendous feeling of love, this tremendous feeling of love overcame me. It nearly picked me off the bench, this feeling. I had never experienced a feeling of love. And the only thing I could say to myself was, this is good orderly direction. This, because everything good, bad, or indifferent, since I had heard those words, everything was good orderly direction. And I said, this is good orderly direction. And I heard myself say to me, loud and clear, nah, Brian, not this time. This is not good orderly direction. This is the God they've been talking about. This is the God of the moons. This is the God of sobriety. And I knew it to be true. And I was just overwhelmed. I mean, here I was, maybe 39 years old, and I'm sitting there, and I got a container of coffee in one hand, a cigarette in the other, the taste of the child's lollipop, and God? I mean, I was just overwhelmed. And I couldn't think of what to say. And what I finally did say was, God, God bless you, God. Like I went over his head to his boss or somebody. I mean, you know, what the hell do I know about God? You know, I'm just waiting to go to work. And I was about 4 years sober when I got a phone call from California, from San Francisco, headquarters for the Marine Fireman Union, Seaman Jr. Now, I hadn't sailed since they flew me home from Tokyo. And they were taking the bicentennial ship out of Bath, Maine. And they were going to cooler up with an East Coast crew. So they said, look, Brian, would you like to be part of this trip? You know, this bicentennial trip, we're crewing her up on the East Coast there. And I hadn't sailed now in 4 years. I said, sure, I'd be honored to. They said, all right, go see the Coast Guard, get your inoculation shots, be ready to go. Within 2 weeks, we're going to fly the crew up to Maine. I said, all right. And about a week before I left, there was a friend of mine, Roy, who was on the drunk. And Ronnie, his sponsor, and another guy went to his house to pick him up, to take him to a detox. And whatever went through Roy's head, I don't know. But by the time he got there, he opened up the window and dove out 27 stories. And it was a mess when he got there. The police was there, the fire engines, everybody was there. He had five kids, he had a wife. You know, it was a mess. Now, Roy was half Jewish and half Irish Catholic. And his mother flew in. They had cremated the body, and she flew in from San Francisco. And there was a lot of recriminations and finger pointing at the memorial service. And Roy had gone to see as a kid. So I got together with his sponsor, his mother, and with the wife. We sat down. I said, look, I'll be leaving in about a week. Why not give me the ashes, and I'll bury him at sea. We'll give him a scene and bury him. And that was about the only thing they agreed on. And I remember Ronnie went and got the ashes. He came to my apartment. He gave me the ashes. The captain had been notified, because he worked for the Seaman Union, that there'll be a burial at sea. And they flew us up to Maine, and on our way to Panama, I happened to run into the captain. I explained who I was. And he says, all right. He says, we'll have a burial maybe tomorrow. He says, you got the death certificate, right? I said, no, I don't have a death certificate. What are you talking about? He said, well, this is an official burial at sea. We'll have to put it in a logbook. He said, I'll tell you what. We'll get to Panama. You call up his wife and have her send all the necessary papers to San Francisco, and we'll bury him in the Pacific. I said, all right, which we did. And the ship sailed. We're on our way to Yokohama, and I ran into the captain, and he said, well, he says, the moment you like to have the burial. I said, well, captain, it's your ship. It's up to you. He said, no, it's your friend. He said, when would you like to hold it? I said, well, seeing captain, then I have, you know, I have a choice. I said, is it possible that we could hold the service on the international dateline? I would like to bury him on the international dateline. He says, all right, when we get there, that's where we'll bury him. And to my way of thinking, ladies and gentlemen, if there's any one human that deserves or should be buried on the international dateline, it's the alcoholic. I mean, we have been international since time began. I mean, since the very beginning. We've been written about in parchments, in the Bible. I mean, we go back to the beginning of fermentation. That's how old we are. We're as old as fermentation. I mean, it was the Iceman and the Neanderthal man, and right alongside of him was us, the drunken man. I mean, we've been there since the very beginning. And the day came, and ladies and gentlemen, it was gorgeous. It was beautiful. God just brought out all the colors. The sky in the Pacific, it was about 6 o'clock at night after dinner. The sky was just aflame with colors. The water was like glass. You could feel the ship starting to lower down. All the passengers came out. All the crew came out. They had the plank there with the ashes and the American flag on top of it. And before we left San Francisco, I got 5 long-stemmed red roses, one for each one of his kids. and I got a yellow rose for his wife, and I stapled it to that plastic Serenity card, and made sort of a, like a wreath. And the captain had to agree to close the service with the Our Father, and when it was over, they picked it up, and there the wreath went in with the ashes, and all of a sudden, from the whistle, you could hear treetop blasts, saluting a departed brother, and you could feel the ship starting to pick, and the black smoke fell approaching out, and all of a sudden they broke out the booms, and all the passengers and the crew, they all started drinking for the celebration of passing, of burying a seaman and passing the international dateline. And I sort of walked back up, and way in the back in the distance in the wake of the ship, I could see the flowers twisting and turning. And I looked up, and I looked at the sky, and I looked at the sea, and I realized where I was. And ladies and gentlemen, I was just overwhelmed with love. I mean, here I was all these years, and here I am, 41 years old, or 42 at the time, cold sober on the international dateline. I just buried a friend. Now, I don't know what went through Roy's head when he opened that window and he dove out, confusion and drunkenness and shame. But here he was being buried on the international dateline with AA Fellowship. Here he was being buried with dignity, with grace and dignity. What the newcomers see when they come into AA, they see in our eyes is hope, but what they don't see in that outstretched hand is the silent gift of dignity. That's what we do. We dignify one another. And the ship sailed on, and I had registered with GSO in New York before I left as an internationalist. Now, international are people who travel all over the world, and there's meetings all over the world, and they gave me the list. And then on that list are the loners. These are people who can't get to meetings. People in lighthouses and way in and nook and cranny, and they can't. And they stay sober by letters and tapes. And there was this one priest, a missionary, that was way up in the hills of Taiwan, way in the back of Taiwan somewhere. And that was one of the ports that I pulled into. And I had corresponded with him. Because sometimes you're in the morning, you're out in the afternoon. I just never got time to get to see this guy. And he said, Brian, if you can ever make it, I'd like to take my first step with you. The man had been sober for 5 years, and he had never told his story, eyeball to eyeball, to another human being, to another alcoholic. It was all done through letters and tapes. And this one particular time, the ship got in. There was enough time. I rented a car with the driver. We went clippity-clop over the mud paddies, and I finally found him. And I spent the whole day with him, a half a day with him, going over his good stuff. And he'd be talking to me, and he'd be talking to me in English, and next thing his eyes would roll in retrospect, and he'd go on in Chinese, and he'd come out, he'd be talking to me in Chinese, and he'd be talking to me in English, and I'm looking at the paper, and I haven't any idea what the hell he's talking about. And ladies and gentlemen, I realized how blessed I had been to sober up in New York, where you're running eyeball to eyeball with another human being. I realized how lucky I was, and I realized how blessed this man was, that there's a place like GSO that keeps corresponding with him, that gives people like me his address to get in touch with him, to seek him out, to have a meeting with him. I realized how blessed he was. And I walked away with the knowledge that AA, don't ever be afraid, ladies and gentlemen, to travel the world, to get out there. AA literally reaches out from the four points of the compass. I think it's something like in 156 or 186 countries. No matter where you go, AA, the hand of AA reaches out. And the great thing about AA, ladies and gentlemen, is if you get to a country or a town or a state and AA isn't there when you get there, then AA is there when you got there. Because you're AA and I'm AA. There's no big mystery to any of this. You know, there's no big mystery. It's just at the right time, the out, stretching out to the suffering alcoholic. And I came back, and with friends in the program, I got registered in Fordham University. I'd run away from school at 15. I got registered, going to work in the tunnels nights and going to school day and school day in the tunnels nights. I graduated in 1982 from Fordham University with a degree in fine art, something that I had been interested in all my life. And I did a lot of things, ladies and gentlemen. I did a lot of things drunk, and I did a lot of things sober. A lot of things proud of sober, a lot of things I was proud of drunk. But the one thing in sobriety that I'm the proudest of, and that was the fact that the one thing I was the proudest of, is the one thing that I was the deepest ashamed of, and that was the fact that I couldn't drive. I didn't have a driver's license. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not talking about driving. I'm talking about phobia. I'm talking phobia. You put me in a tunnel and run anything. Show me how to run a plane. I'll fly a plane. Something about driving. I'm talking phobic. And I've been, about 10, 12 years ago, something like that, I was running around with a young lady. She came, she knocked at the door, and I opened the door, and she turned around, and she said, put your shoes on. I'm going to register you in driving school. I said, look, don't come around here torturing me with that. Leave me alone, will you? She said, put your shoes on. I put my shoes on. She literally took me by the hand to Yorkville Driving Academy and registered me. And before I go to work, the car would be out there to take me for the driving lessons. I come into work that night. They could tell if I was had a lesson that day. I looked like the Michelin man. I come in, oh, God, the pain and muscles are from the fear. And the guys in New York, you don't have any cars, you know, but the guys from Bronx and Brooklyn, they would come in and they showed me how to drive through the tunnel and over the bridges, and the day came for me to take the test, and I took the test. And about 6 weeks later, I come home about 1 o'clock in the morning, I opened the mailbox, and there was this here letter from the motor vehicle. And I took it up, and I remember making myself a cup of tea, sitting at the kitchen table, and I opened it up, and there was my driver's license. They say, beyond your wildest dreams. Beyond your wildest expectation. Ladies and gentlemen, never in my life did I ever think I would have a driver's license. I mean, I remember taking the dish towel and sticking it in my mouth because I was afraid the neighbors would hear me crying. Never did I ever fantasize that I had a big Cadillac and I picked up girls or I was a great car racing driver. None of those fantasies were beyond my wildest dreams. And here I was with a driver's license. And I had it for about 6 months, and one day, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know, it was a Saturday, I don't know what overcame me. I woke up, I got showered, I got shaved, I went up to Avis, and I rented a car. And it was this one diner out in Rockaway, and I knew I had to get over the bridge and drive straight out to Northern Boulevard where the made a run, and then if I kept driving, it would take me right to this diner. And I remember I was going across the bridge and I'm driving the car and the truck drivers are coming by beeping the horn, move over, you dumb bastard, move over. And I'm there and I get out to Northern Boulevard and I don't know how long it was. I finally got to the diner. And I remember getting out of the car and the sweat was just pouring off me. And the sweat pouring out of my shoes and it was 3 steps to get up into the diner. And I remember I was having a hard time trying to get my leg up on the step because my pants were all wet and stuck to my ass. And I got up, and I walked in, I sat down on a stool, and ladies and gentlemen, they say everybody has 15 minutes of fame. Well, I had 3 cups of coffee of it. I sat there with that soaking wet, ladies and gentlemen, and never in my life was I as proud of myself as I was then. For the first time, I figured maybe I could do something right. Maybe I can be a man after all. Maybe I can do it. I don't know. And I remember getting back in the car, as I'm back in the car out, that voice started digging into me, saying, look at him turning that wheel, look at him look over his shoulder, look at him turning that wheel with one hand, what a man. And I got back, ladies and gentlemen, I paid Avis, I walked around the corner, and that is the last time I drove a car. The hell with that, ladies and gentlemen. I don't drink and I don't drive. Greg got me here sober, he's getting me back. He's getting me back, and that's enough for me. That's good. I don't have to prove nothing to nobody. And ladies and gentlemen, I mean, here I am. I had to leave the tunnels early with early retirement because of black lung. I left in 87. I'm early retired. I'm 27 years sober. I have a college education, and I have a driver's license, ladies and gentlemen. And I wish I could stand up here and tell you I finally know what I want to be when I grow up. I wish I could stay here and just raise my hand and say, I'm hitting the mark. I'm really hitting. I'm potentiating. Here I am. But the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And I've learned in these rooms it's really not that important to know who you are. What is important is to recognize who you are not. I'm not that young man the FBI took off from Mobile, Alabama in handcuffs and stood trial for near killing a man on a ship. I'm not that young man the FBI took off and stood trial for mutiny in New York. I'm not that young, dirty old man trying to panhandle to get money to get into a drink. I'm not that guy dragging a woman out by the hair of the head, dragging her back into the bar. Thanks to you, ladies and gentlemen, I am not a lot of things today. I am not a lot of things. And somehow by seeing the many things that I am not, somehow I begin to see the many things that I am.
And on those rare occasions when I do have the courage and the wisdom to look, I see the many things I can yet become. If I continue adhering to the principles of this program, if I continue staying away from the first thing, if I continue coming to meetings, if I continue reaching out to the suffering alcoholics. I was in San Francisco on that ship in 1976, it was Christmas evening, I went ashore in search of a meeting. And I was out in the mission, it was a dingy little storefront with little decorations. And in it, at that meeting, I heard a lady make a statement. In its spiritual simplicity, it took all the steps and all the traditions and all Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson and the Eds and the Russes, and it reduced everything to its lowest denominator. Listen to what this woman said. She said, by no means has AA opened the gates of heaven and let me in. But they sure opened the gates of hell and let me out. And that's what we're all about, ladies and gentlemen. We're just simply a room full of alcoholics showing that gate, reaching in, helping another alcoholic out. On my right bended knees, ladies and gentlemen, I thank the Almighty God for each and every one of you. And on my other knee, kneeling, I thank each and every one of you for me. Thank you for me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.